Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Tom Engelhardt, creator of the Nation Institute's TomDispatch.com website, who assesses the importance of the recently published WikiLeaks documents and their possible effect on U.S.-Afghan war policy. Jennifer Jaff, executive director of the group Advocacy for Patients with Chronic Illness, who describes new federal regulations that now provide health insurance for patients with pre-existing medical conditions. And professor of philosophy and author Joy Gordon, who explains why she believes economic sanctions targeting nations for their behavior are ineffective at motivating change and mostly harm innocent civilians. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Egypt, police brutality has reached near-epidemic proportions for many citizens, according to a torture diary entitled Egyptians in an Emergency State, released by the Cairo-based Nadim Center for the Rehabilitation of Victims and Violence. Recent cases recorded in the diary include an 18-year-old man who was thrown off a third-floor roof and remains in a coma. In a separate entry, a family was forcibly taken to the police station where the father was beaten and the mother was threatened with rape. According to the Christian Science Monitor, street protests were organized against the killing of businessman Khalid Said in Alexandria by Egyptian police, who beat him to death in the street. In late July, two policemen were charged with unlawful arrest and excessive use of force. Lawyers for the Said family are filing murder charges against the two police officers. Human rights groups have criticized the abuse of the three-decade-old emergency law by President Hosni Mubarak, which was put in place continuously since the assassination of President Anwar el-Sadat in 1981. The government claimed the law would only be used in cases of terrorism and drug trafficking. The emergency laws were extended for 2 years in May and may play a role in next year's presidential election. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is in the midst of a new gold rush, with more than $1 billion worth being mined each year, boosting the profits of Western mining companies that are increasingly active in the Central African country. Meanwhile, Congo's millions of poor continue to survive by getting only a tiny share of the gold profits. According to Mother Jones magazine, the gold mines became the prized possessions of longtime dictator Mobutu Sese Seko, who ruled the Congo with Western assistance for over 30 years. During that era, Mobutu accumulated a reported personal fortune of $4 billion. He kept tight control over the mines in northeast Congo, which finally stopped producing gold due to massive corruption. The gold mines were a valuable commodity to rival militia factions in the recent civil war, which began in 1998. With the aid of the United Nations peacekeepers, the mines are again in control of the Congolese government. With the relative quiet, Western mining companies are eager to restart operations. In the gold-rich town of Mungwala, the world's third-largest gold mining giant, Anglo Gold Ashanti, is preparing to extract 2.5 million ounces of gold, worth over $3 billion at current prices. The Washington Post reports that the Obama administration is seeking to give the FBI new powers to obtain the Internet activity records of individuals without a court order. The White House is attempting to insert four words, electronic communications transactional records, into the list of items the FBI can seek without a judicial order. Information requested could include the Internet address an individual uses to send email, the time and date of an email, and an individual's browser's history. Michelle Richardson of the American Civil Liberties Union called the Obama proposal incredibly bold given the amount of electronic data the government is already getting. From 2003 to 2006, the Justice Department issued over 192,000 national security letters, which don't require a court order, according to an Inspector General report during the Bush administration. Audits found the FBI had possibly violated its own agency regulations by issuing national security letters without justification. Greg Nodheim of the Center for Democracy and Technology warned that the expanded use of national security letters exposes associational information protected by the First Amendment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In one of the largest unauthorized releases of classified military files since the Vietnam War-era Pentagon Papers in 1971, the website WikiLeaks published some 91,000 documents of Pentagon field reports related to the war in Afghanistan. The documents, totaling over 200,000 pages, covers the period from January 2004 to December 2009, spanning the last 5 years of the Bush presidency and the first year of the Obama administration. The Archive of Military Logs reveals a grim picture of a failing war that polls find is increasingly unpopular among a majority of Americans. The documents describe unreported incidents of U.S. and NATO forces killing of Afghan civilians, expansion of a CIA assassination program targeting suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders, the Taliban's acquisition of ground-to-air heat-seeking missiles, and the use of Predator and Reaper remote-controlled drones piloted from a U.S. base in Nevada. Among the most publicized information from the classified documents in the U.S. were reports that Pakistan's military intelligence agency, the ISI, continues to actively support and strategize the war with the Taliban leadership. The White House and Pentagon have condemned the release of the documents, as some commentators and politicians call for the prosecution of those who leaked the files and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, an Australian citizen. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Tom Engelhardt, creator of the Nation Institute's TomDispatch.com website and co-founder of the American Empire Project. He assesses the importance of the WikiLeaks documents and their possible effect on U.S.-Afghan war policy.
Well, I'll tell you, the major point to me is not what's in the documents. It's true that if you had been reading, for instance, TomDispatch.com or other places like it, you wouldn't be surprised by most of what's there. I mean, the news is, you know, but the real story here isn't specifically what's in the documents, but that for the, for the second time in a month, the first time being General McChrystal's escapade with Rolling Stone, his firing, and the appointment of General Petraeus, a runaway story about Afghanistan has burst its way through onto the front pages of American papers and to the top of the news. This has really been, the Afghan war has been the war that time more or less forgot, in the United States anyway. And I think that's probably the biggest news. And with it goes, I mean, it's true that if you were reading Tom Dispatch, you probably knew a lot of this. But generally, if you were an American out there just reading whatever was in the mainstream, you had to get pretty deep into your newspaper most of the time to find anything about this stuff. So I think this is news, and I think the basic message of these documents, and only about 75,000 have been released so far. I think the Times, the Guardian, and Der Spiegel got to look at the full 91 or 92,000, but there are about 15,000 that WikiLeaks hasn't even released yet. I think the real message is pretty blunt, which is Afghanistan grim, Afghan war going badly. I mean, it's not complicated at some level, and in fact, what these documents describe is a war that at every level, 9 years later almost, is going disastrously for the United States by the standards of the people who are fighting it.
The Obama administration responding to these leaked documents basically said, well, this covered a period of time, 6 years in the Afghan war, that extended from 2004 under President Bush to December 2009 when Barack Obama launched his new surge, his 30,000 troop surge in Afghanistan and what they claim is a change policy there. Is there any reason to believe that the documents here paint a picture that's outdated?
Well, I would say this is disingenuous because, first of all, the Pentagon Papers, which this is often compared to, although it's a complicated analogy to make, by the time they were released during the Vietnam War, what was in them was 3 years old. I mean, these documents end in December 2009. This is a little less than a year after Obama came into power. In that same December, he had already surged in March of 2009. He doubled down again that very December. So I would say that the last of them actually reflect the Obama world. I mean, I mean, if anything, under Obama, things have gotten worse, not better. I mean, in other words, it's true that this is, quote, old news, but the new news, if you're dealing with most of these subjects, for instance, the Taliban surge, because we surged, but the Taliban surge too. The Taliban surge. Worse in 2010 than in 2009. The Afghan army, corruption, you know, inadequacy, numbers not what they say they are, et cetera, et cetera. Same in 2010 as 2009. I mean, I think in essence, I mean, what they're claiming is simply that they are, that their counterinsurgency program is a new program, although they were doing that in 2009 too. The people who are saying this is old news, other than the administration itself, were people for whom, until recently, the Afghan war was no news. So, you know, the first response was, well, old news, nothing new here, out of date anyway. Now, the newest one is the administration, particularly Secretary of Defense Gates and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mullen, have grabbed this story, and they finally turned to the issue of blood. But in this case, the blood is not the blood that's on American hands. It's the prospective blood that's going to be on the hands of Julian Assange, the fellow who's the founder of WikiLeaks, because some of these documents that he released had the names of Afghan informers in them, and they may be killed.
Tom, do you think that the release of these documents will in any way affect the course of the war, how the Pentagon's going to fight it, and how the Obama White House is going to respond?
I think that the two areas where it's likely to have some actual effect, one is at home, where any time that the war comes more or less out of the closet, where it comes out of hiding, and it ends up front and center, it makes people feel less good about it here. So that's one place. The second place is Pakistan, where, you know, there is this story. The story that gained traction here is the Pakistanis are dealing with us, but they're double timing because they're also running the Taliban. And again, well, that information in these documents came from, basically came up from Afghan intelligence, which at least The Guardian felt didn't indicate reliable information. Certainly people have been talking for years about the fact that the Pakistani intelligence, ISI, its intelligence agency, had a relationship to the Taliban and possibly a very close one. And the release of these documents forces the Obama administration potentially to put even more pressure on the Pakistanis. And I don't think that's going to play out well at all in Pakistan, where we're looked on as largely by public opinion already as an enemy state. So I think that it is creating certain problems, yes.
That was Tom Engelhart, creator of the Nation Institute's TomDispatch.com website. His most recent book is titled The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. As part of health care reform legislation passed last March, federal regulations were issued on July 30th for a new temporary insurance plan in all states for adults with pre-existing medical conditions and no insurance. 30 states are inaugurating their own plans, while in the other 20 states, plans will be administered directly by the federal government. Advocates say the new program is a major improvement over the status quo, where such insurance coverage was astronomically expensive and thus out of reach for most of those in need. But the new plans are still expensive. They will stay in place until 2014, when all insurance coverage for pre-existing conditions will be handled under the federal legislation. Children with pre-existing conditions are already covered. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Jennifer Jaff, executive director of the Connecticut-based group Advocacy for Patients with Chronic Illness, which provides free information and advocacy to people seeking advice on how to get and keep health insurance coverage. She talks about how the new federal system will work and what challenges remain.
As part of the health reform law, Congress eliminated pre-existing condition exclusions for children effective right away, but for adults only in 2014. And they recognized the need to do something for uninsured adults with pre-existing conditions between now and 2014. And so they decided to set up a program of temporary high-risk pools, which are called pre-existing condition insurance plans, or PCIPs. And every state is going to have one. Some of the states, roughly 30 states, have agreed to run their own PCIP, whereas 20 states are having the federal government run their plan. In Connecticut, the governor has decided that the state will run the high-risk pool, the PSIP. It is not available to people who currently have insurance because the idea is that this is a temporary stopgap measure for people who have been uninsured for a long time and can't get insurance due to a pre-existing condition. It's really not meant as an alternative for people who already have insurance. Of course, that leaves a lot of people still with problems, but this is certainly a good step in the right direction, providing an alternative for people who can't get insurance otherwise. One of the most important features of the new plan is that it will be, the premiums are going to be based on standard rates across the industry in the state of Connecticut. And so unlike the pre-existing high-risk pool in Connecticut, which is called the Health Reinsurance Association and which costs about $1,000 a month for premiums, this is going to cost half that. So it's still going to be out of reach of too many people, but it will provide an alternative for people who can afford a reasonable premium but can't get insurance only because of their pre-existing condition.
Jennifer Jaff, is it true that you have to be denied coverage by an insurance company before you can access the new insurance plan?
In order to be eligible for the new pre-existing condition insurance plan, you have to have been turned down for insurance due to your pre-existing condition, and you have to have a letter saying that. That's really not much of an obstacle for people with pre-existing conditions. All you have to do is apply for individual insurance, and you will, in fact, get rejected, and that will be the reason. So that's really not a big hoop to jump through. I would suggest, though, that people do that right away so they have that letter in their hands and are able to enroll in the new high-risk pool as soon as it becomes available.
What's the point of requiring people to be without any insurance for 6 months before they can sign up for the new high-risk pool?
Well, insurance companies have been denying coverage of people with pre-existing conditions for as long as I can remember, and the reason is because their health care is predictably more expensive. Of course, there's nothing to say that a healthy person isn't going to develop some kind of illness or cancer or something like that, but insurance companies do their best to weed out the people who are going to cost them a lot of money. The pre-existing condition exclusions actually go beyond just diagnosed illnesses. They relate to any illness for which you have had symptoms and for which a reasonably prudent person would have sought medical attention.
Can you put this new program in perspective compared to what existed before and what's coming in 2014?
The fact that the insurance companies have done this for so long and have created a society in which there are many, many people who are sick and therefore cannot get insurance for any amount of money, that's probably one of the greatest stimuluses to the healthcare reform movement. It was because of all of these uninsured people who had no options that advocates have been yelling and screaming about this for years, and it's part of one of the main reasons that we have healthcare reform. And I think what we really have to focus on is that in 2014, we will no longer have a society that is divided between healthy people and sick people. Everybody, regardless of health status, will be able to buy insurance. Not only that, but insurance will become more affordable because there will be subsidies. And for people who are really low income, who are not currently eligible for Medicaid, they will become eligible for Medicaid. So there will be a way for everybody to have insurance starting in 2014, and that's really a very exciting thing and a very important step towards real equality among consumers who now will be entitled to the same health care as their healthy counterparts.
That was Jennifer Jaff, Executive Director of the Connecticut-based group Advocacy for Patients with Chronic Illness. For more information, visit the group's website at advocacyforpatients.org. After the 1991 U.S. coalition war against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, following his invasion of neighboring Kuwait, Washington succeeded in imposing a severe economic embargo against Iraq, administered by the UN, that remained in effect until President Bush's 2003 invasion and overthrow of Hussein's regime. By many accounts, the post-Persian Gulf War sanctions against Iraq resulted in a humanitarian catastrophe, where basic services such as health care, water treatment, agriculture, and education were crippled. As Fairfield University professor of philosophy Joy Gordon recounts in her new book, Invisible War, the U.S. and Iraq Sanctions, between 670,000 and 880,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 died as a result of the sanctions. Gordon maintains that the suffering borne by the Iraqi people under the UN sanctions, mostly driven by American policy, served to strengthen, not weaken, Saddam's hold on power. Now, with growing concern within the UN Security Council that Iran is engaged in a covert nuclear weapons program, the U.S. is pushing for ever harsher sanctions against the Islamic Republic. President Obama has proclaimed that the smart sanctions he's advocating against Iran will avoid indiscriminately harming the innocent. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Professor Gordon, who explains why she believes economic sanctions targeting nations for their behavior, whatever the label, are ineffective at motivating change and result in harm to innocent civilians.
You know, I think we're used to thinking of sanctions as sort of this very attractive middle route, that it seems more than, you know, just words of diplomacy, and it seems less violent than military intervention. And the truth is, it doesn't have any of the kinds of costs of military intervention. It doesn't have the political risks or the cost to your own military forces. And it does have more clout than diplomacy in one particular regard, which has to do with posturing for your own constituency. So sanctions have always been attractive because it seems like you're doing something, but you're not doing something that's going to put you as a political leader at risk. The problem is that sanctions are pretty much always indiscriminate, and they're pretty much always ineffective. If by effective, what you mean is getting the target state to do what you're telling it you want to do, whether it's has to do with aggression or human rights violations. The research on sanctions shows that in the 20th century, out of 120 instances of sanctions being imposed, in about 3% of the cases, is it the case that the target state actually does what you've demanded it do as a response to the sanctions. So they just sort of don't work by that kind of a measure. And what they also are is almost without exception overbroad and indiscriminate. If you contract the economy, who's hurt? Well, it's the poor. It's the ones who are most vulnerable, the ones who are most marginal, infants, young children, the elderly, the sick, women, and the poor are the ones who are hurt most when, for example, the quality of potable water goes down. Who is hurt least? Well, it's the leadership. It's the political and military and economic elite, the ones that are responsible for the decisions that you think are wrong in the first place.
Now, when we hear about Iran and the so-called smart sanctions, is this, I guess that's opposed to the dumb sanctions or the overbroad and, just widespread indiscriminate sanctions you just described. Is there any difference in what the United Nations, spearheaded by the Obama administration, is trying to do with these new sanctions imposed against Iran?
Well, the notion of smart sanctions got formulated in the late 1990s, really in response to the situation of Iraq, which was unprecedented. During the Cold War, sanctions never were comprehensive, and they never had an enormous humanitarian impact. Because if the Soviets sanctioned someone, they could trade with the U.S., and if the U.S. sanctioned someone, they could trade with the Soviets. So the Iraq sanctions come along, and they are comprehensive, because they're imposed by the Security Council under Chapter 7 of the Charter. Literally, every nation in the world is obligated to enforce them. And because Iraq was so vulnerable, it was so dependent on imports and exports, then the sanctions, in combination with the massive bombing strikes of 1991, were really devastating. Child mortality increased by 250%. Malnutrition was off the charts. Every major system in the country collapsed. Health, education, electricity, water treatment, everything. So in the mid to late 90s, people started, political scientists and ethicists and a broad range of people started saying, well, there's actually ethical problems with sanctions because they're so overbroad. Look at Iraq. Different proposals started emerging for this idea of targeted sanctions. So in the case of the U.S. says, we have targeted sanctions on Iran. We are targeting their gas and oil industries. Well, Iran's gas and oil industries account for more than a quarter of its economy. And as you can imagine in the U.S., if a quarter of our economy took a hit, that would not be targeted at all. That would affect all costs of goods, all transportation, heating fuel, if the U.S. were successful in undermining Iran's gas and oil industries. So there's this language of smart sanctions, but that's as good an example of an indiscriminate sanction as you can imagine. The UN sanctions are overbroad in a different way. They have lists. So if you look at these lists, you think, oh, well, these must be targeted sanctions because there's lists of here's the name of this company and the name of that individual. So I see that they're aiming at a very specific person or entity, except that some of the things on the list are the largest bank, the largest bank in Iran, and Iran's national shipping lines. So, in fact, if you succeeded at what the claim is, which is to compromise Iran's ability to engage in financial transfers in the global financial market, or succeeded in undermining Iran's ability to import and export goods because their shipping lines have been compromised, then of course those are indiscriminate. But to the extent the sanctions are effective on Iran, they will be indiscriminate as they've been implemented and designed, and they will hurt the wrong people, and they will not touch those responsible for whatever policies we're objecting to.
That was Joy Gordon, professor of philosophy at Fairfield University and author of the new book, Invisible War, the U.S. and Iraq Sanctions. Read her recent article, Lessons We Should Have Learned from the Iraqi Sanctions, online at foreignpolicy.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.